Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising. This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and in the early hours of Saturday, 17th of August, these are our main stories. We're in Washington for a reaction to a US congresswoman's decision not to accept an Israeli offer with conditions to visit her grandmother in the occupied West Bank. The brother of the leader of the Afghan Taliban is killed in a mosque in Pakistan.
Friday prayers were still going on. Some people ran away. Some were injured. Others were killed.
At a closed UN Security Council meeting, India and Pakistan are urged not to take aggressive action over Kashmir. Also in this podcast, is Australia bullying its Pacific neighbours over climate change? And we look ahead to general elections in Austria in September. It's a row involving two US congresswomen, Israel and President Trump. And it's taken a new twist. We've covered the story before of how Democrats Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar were banned from entering Israel because of their support for a boycott of the country, a decision egged on by Mr. Trump. The ban triggered widespread criticism, and Jerusalem responded by granting permission to Rashida Tlaib to visit her elderly grandmother in the occupied West Bank, on condition she didn't express certain views. Initially, it seemed the invitation would be accepted, but then came news that Ms. Tlaib had decided not to go because, as she put it, visiting my grandmother under these oppressive conditions meant to humiliate me would break my grandmother's heart. I asked our correspondent in Washington, Chris Buckler, why the congresswoman had changed her mind.
Well, Rashida Tlaib has made out that this was an emotional decision, at one stage even suggesting that it could be the last opportunity that she would have to see her elderly grandmother. But in a full and very detailed statement, she now says she has to consider how it would be against much of what she stands for. In the statement, she says when she won the election to become a United States Congresswoman, many Palestinians, especially her grandmother, felt a sense of hope, a hope that they would finally have a voice. And I think she feels that ultimately this would be her voice being silenced, because part of the agreement would see her essentially not be able to voice her support for what is a boycott Israel movement, which she is a firm member of. She would have to silence that voice while she was there, and she says that is not acceptable. And she's also angry that essentially her grandmother is being used, in her view, as a kind of political bargaining chip in all of this. But Israeli Interior Minister has not really responded to that with any sense of kind of emotion on her feeling that this is about her own relationship with her family. He said her hatred for Israel has actually overcome her love for her grandmother.
And Chris, has there been any response in Washington, both from the Democrats and from President Trump?
Well, it goes without saying that the Democrats are furious and they blame Donald Trump, who you might remember said that it would show weakness on behalf of the Israeli government to allow her and also another congresswoman into Israel at this particular time because of some comments that they have made. And if you take a look at Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib, they are part of this group that has become known as the Squad in Washington. They're a small group of congresswomen who President Trump believes are on the left side of the Democratic Party, and he has used to attack several times in order to try and say that they are the unacceptable face of the Democratic Party. Now, Democratic leaders say that is just not acceptable. But it's Republicans, too, who have been weighing in, saying that they are concerned about this, because ultimately there are people inside Congress who feel that Israel is America's ally. They should be standing up and doing whatever they could to try and make sure that they are represented. And even Israel lobby groups have been suggesting that this is a bad move because it separates Democrats and Republicans, and potentially it makes Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu really on the side of President Trump and the Republicans up against the Democrats. And in the long term, there are questions about whether that is good for Israel and relationships between there and the US.
Chris Buckler in Washington. With speculation growing that the Taliban and the US could be close to announcing an historic peace deal, the brother of the leader of the Afghan Taliban has been killed in a bomb blast. The incident happened at a mosque in Pakistan, close to the Afghan border. This man was among those who witnessed the blast.
Friday prayers were still going on when the blast happened. Some people ran away. Some were injured. Others were killed. We picked up the injured and brought them to the hospital. Those who'd been martyred were simply lying there.
Our correspondent in Islamabad, Sukunda Kamani, has been following developments.
So what we understand is that just as Friday prayers were about to begin, a bomb exploded. Now, according to police officials, a bomb had been placed underneath the chair of the imam, and it was fitted with a timer device. According to a local witness, the prayers were just about to start when the explosion happened. As a result, at least four people had been killed, including that imam. And we've been told by Taliban sources and other local sources in the area that that imam was the brother of the Taliban leader Mullah Haybatullah. He's not someone who was particularly well known before Hafiz Ahmadullah, but the area where this attack or this blast has happened, the town of Kuchlak, just outside Quetta, close to the Pakistan-Afghan border, is somewhere where we understand Mullah Haybatullah, the leader of the Taliban, used to be based prior to becoming leader of the Taliban. And in fact, sources have told us that Mullah Haybatullah, in fact, used to lead prayers at this same mosque that was attacked. So it was certainly somewhere that would have been on the radar.
And have we any idea who carried this attack out and why?
Well, there's no claim of responsibility so far, but this comes at a really crucial time for the Afghan peace process. We're expecting quite possibly that in the coming days or perhaps weeks that there'll be an announcement of a peace deal between the Taliban and the United States. Now, there's been, as I say, no claim of responsibility, but I was speaking to one Pakistani politician who was saying that he believed the Afghan intelligence services would be most likely people to be involved in this attack, especially given the fact that it was a bomb fitted with a timer device, so it wasn't a suicide bombing, which would have pointed the finger towards a rival militant group such as the Islamic State group.
But why would the intelligence services want to carry out an attack like this?
Well, it's not clear. And at this stage, of course, it's speculation whether the Afghan intelligence services are indeed involved. But one of the aspects of the anticipated peace deal between the Americans and the Taliban that we understand is that there may not be a ceasefire between Afghan forces and the Taliban. So violence between the Afghan government and the Taliban could continue even with some kind of agreement being reached between the Americans and the Taliban. So that could possibly provide some context about why an attack like this would happen. But really, at this stage, this is speculation.
Sukunda Kamani. China has accused India of provoking tension with its decision to strip Kashmir of its autonomy. Speaking after a closed-door meeting of the UN Security Council, the Chinese ambassador said Beijing opposed any unilateral action that complicated the situation in the disputed region.
It's obvious that the constitutional amendment by India has changed the status quo in Kashmir, causing tensions in the region. And we call upon the relevant parties to exercise restraint.
India and Pakistan have fought three wars over Kashmir, and they each control part of the region. Pakistan's ambassador, Maliha Lodi, promised to highlight the problems faced by Kashmiris.
The people of Jammu and Kashmir may be locked up. Their voices may not be heard in their own homes and in their own land. But their voices were heard today at the United Nations, and their voices will always be heard because Pakistan will always stand by them.
Maliha Lodi. Leaders of a number of tiny island states in the Pacific, as well as Australia and New Zealand, have been meeting this week in Tuvalu to discuss climate change. The grouping's called the Pacific Islands Forum, and the aim's to come up with a strong statement urging greater and swifter action on curbing emissions. But they were thwarted by the Australian Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, who insisted that calls to end coal mining in the region be taken out of the final communique. David Panuelo is president of the Federated States of Micronesia. Does he think Australia needs to do more?
I was one of the leaders that turned around and asked Australia, why can't they come along with a strong commitment with the Pacific Island countries. And I've said that, you know, Australia is deeply rooted in the use of fossil fuels. So I'm sure they're in a schedule that they're trying to meet. But we admire countries like New Zealand. They've declared already their commitment to be carbon-free by 2050. And so are countries like Norway, UK, Germany. So I did ask Australia why is it so difficult for them to come along with the rest of the Pacific Island countries. But at the end of the retreat by leaders, the Pacific came away really happy because the language of the Kainaki Declaration for Urgent Climate Action Now, we succeeded. All the language was not watered down by Australia, and we're going to take this document to the next level at the United Nations when Secretary General Guterres will hold the Climate Action Summit.
Yeah. Why did he say that Australia didn't manage to water down the language of the communique? I mean, my understanding is that it was requested by the Pacific states that there would be some reference to an end to coal mining at some point in the future, and Australia wanted any reference to coal just taken out.
Well, coal was not taken out. We referred to Secretary General Guterres' statement, which included coal, but it may not be definitely right in the declaration, but it's in the reference to what the Secretary General said, that we must go forward with the reduction of emission into the environment, and including countries' obligations under the Paris Agreement, declare before 2020 their commitments to be carbon-free by mid-century.
Do you think, though, that Australia is going to meet its commitments? I mean, the latest figures that I've seen are that 75% of its electricity comes from coal. I mean, it's going to really struggle to get anywhere near its commitments on cutting emissions, isn't it?
The Prime Minister did say they're doing a lot of commitments. It's an internal process I'm sure they're working on. But our Blue Pacific region needs to call for more urgent action at the United Nations and indeed in every nation to implement in full and in haste the Paris Agreement. So in no unclear terms, that was very strong by the Pacific Island countries.
So you're not being bullied by Australia on this?
They try to do what they can in terms of advancing their position, but the Pacific Island countries were steadfast in keeping our position, so there was no watering down of our declaration.
David Panuelo, President of the Federated States of Micronesia, talking there to James Menendez. The authorities in the Democratic Republic of Congo say there's been a setback in their efforts to contain a year-long outbreak of Ebola, with the new province reporting its first cases of the disease. A mother and her child tested positive for the virus in South Kivu, making it the third province in the DRC to be affected. I asked our reporter in Kinshasa, Gaius Kweni, how Ebola had spread.
This disease reached South Kivu through a woman who travelled to visit family members in Beni, which is an epicenter of the Ebola virus. And actually, it's one of the main cities that was touched by the virus. Now, this woman went to visit family members, and she was listed already as a high-risk contact by the Ebola response team in Beni. And her family members misled the team, telling the team that, no, this woman had gone back home to South Kivu. But then she was stopped at the border with Uganda. And as she was being brought back to Beni, she escaped again, somehow managed to travel up to South Kivu, which is her hometown now. And along the way, she kept on changing her names on the list. So it was very hard for the teams to keep track. She died 2 days ago, and her young boy was also found being positive. Local authorities from South Kivu, they already say that they identified some people who were in touch with her, like health workers, people who took part in her funeral. They have all been vaccinated and under observation.
So in general, how are the authorities trying to contain this outbreak?
The authorities are putting almost everywhere hand-washing stations so that people who are coming in and who are going out of the province will be washing their hands. And the other thing also authorities are trying to do is encourage people to come and denounce anybody who is hiding having Ebola symptoms.
All this is going on with just one person going where they should not have been when they were potentially contagious. Are they introducing punishments to make sure that people don't travel once they've been identified as possibly a carrier of Ebola?
The main problem is not people traveling. In the past, people who have been contacts, they have traveled across borders as long as they are being followed monitored, that's not a problem. However, if they escape, then it's very hard to follow up and know if they start developing symptoms or not. The main problem is now in the mentality of people, showing people that developing Ebola symptoms isn't the end, and it doesn't mean that somebody becomes problematic. So it's a question of changing mentality and perception.
Gaius Kaweni in Kinshasa. Still to come in this podcast, the German choir that looks set to remain boys only. That's after a court ruled that preventing girls from joining is not sexual discrimination. Now to Zimbabwe, where the last time people took to the streets in protests over the economy, at least 8 people were killed by the security forces. That was back in January over rises in the price of fuel. On Friday, no casualties were reported in renewed protests over the government's handling of the economy. But riot police used tear gas and batons to disperse hundreds of people from the streets in what was an illegal gathering. Before they were chased away, the demonstrators danced and sang as they voiced their opposition to the government. Despite legal appeals by the opposition movement for democratic change, the demonstration was banned and officially it had been called off. But many Zimbabweans are getting increasingly angry about the economic crisis there. Inflation is rampant and there are shortages of food, water and power. These protesters said it was time for things to change.
We want national dialogue, not political dialogue. So we are telling Mnangagwa that, please, come and sit down for national dialogue with Chamisa.
If we demonstrate peacefully, we want change because we are tired of promises, promises, promises. We are tired. Enough is enough.
It's all reminiscent of Zimbabwe under the former president, Robert Mugabe. And yet the man who effectively deposed him, Emmerson Mnangagwa, promised things would change politically and economically. For MDC leader Nelson Chamisa, Mr. Mnangagwa is even worse than his predecessor.
There's been change in the negative, change in regression. Lives have gone worse, freedoms have been eroded, democracy has been weakened. It's clear that human rights abuses have increased. So you will see that the situation has deteriorated. Mugabe is proving to be a saint, far more better than Mr. Mnangagwa. In fact, Mr. Mnangagwa has redefined the levels of tyranny, the levels of dictatorship, the levels of inability, incompetence and incapacity to lead.
Our correspondent in Harare is Shingai Nyoka. Here's her assessment of what happened on the streets on Friday.
The protesters seem to have gone for good now. They had converged in the early hours of the morning at the Africa Unity Square where the demonstrations were supposed to begin. And this was even after the police ban and as the MDC leaders had gone to court to try and overturn the police ban. And so they were there singing, dancing on the streets. But then what we saw was that the police moved in as soon as the court upheld the police ban, set on the demonstrators who effectively had staged a sit-in on the streets, beat many of them. We saw one woman laying on the ground seriously injured and she had to be carried away by medics. And even after they were dispersed, the protesters, or some of them, kept coming back again and again, showing their frustration. And they say that they're not afraid to die, that Emmerson Mnangagwa needs to get the message that things in Zimbabwe are desperate and he needs to do something to change them.
Shingai Nyoka in the Zimbabwean capital, Harare. The chief executive of the Hong Kong-based airline Cathay Pacific, Rupert Hogg, has resigned in the aftermath of pro-democracy protests which shut down the territory's international airport. Karishma Vaswani reports.
The resignation of Cathay Pacific boss Rupert Hogg has come as a shock for the industry. In a statement, Mr. Hogg said that it had been an honour to run Cathay, but that these have been challenging weeks for the airline, and it is right that he takes responsibility. He is being replaced by Augustus Tang, a veteran of the firm. Cathay's management had flip-flopped on a policy of first telling its staff that it would not stop them from joining the pro-democracy demonstrations in Hong Kong, but had to change that after pressure from Beijing's aviation regulator, which had ordered the airline to suspend workers who support the protests.
Karishma Vaswani. Austria currently has a caretaker government after the ruling coalition collapsed following a scandal involving the former head of the Freedom Party, one of the parties in the coalition. The Chancellor, Sebastian Kurz, tried to stay on as leader of a minority government, but Parliament dismissed him and his cabinet, saying he was partly to blame for the scandal, since he'd invited the far-right Freedom Party back into power. Fresh elections will take place in the autumn, with Mr. Kurz and his Conservative People's Party doing well in opinion polls. Bethany Bell reports from Burgenland in eastern Austria.
Supporters of Austria's Conservative People's Party gather for a hike with their leader, Sebastian Kurz. It's hot and sunny, and the mood is upbeat, despite the fact that Mr. Kurz's previous government, which collapsed in May, was the first in recent Austrian history to lose a vote of no confidence. As we walked through woods and vineyards hung with grapes, Mr. Kurz told me he's hoping to win at the new election in September.
Well, I think that many people in Austria want that we continue our way and our work for the Republic of Austria.
Many people are wondering that if you are to win in September, who you might go into a coalition with.
To be honest, we don't know yet. Of course, our goal is to be as strong as possible. And after the elections, we will see which party will be the best to partner with.
A number of people have said they're quite concerned about the Freedom Party, especially given the collapse of the last coalition.
Well, of course, they made mistakes. This is the reason why we had to ask for early elections. But the work in the government was quite good.
Around 1,000 people are hiking through the vineyards here in eastern Austria, along with Sebastian Kurz. Many of them are wearing turquoise T-shirts and turquoise sunglasses, the colour of Mr. Kurz's party. Official electioneering hasn't begun yet, but many people say they hope that Mr. Kurz will be the next Chancellor of Austria.
He's a great guy, and so we are standing behind him and push him.
He's a very charismatic person, and in his young age he achieved very much. And we're here to support him on his way to success.
His chances look good according to the latest opinion polls. The big question seems to be who he'll go into coalition with.
In dieser Wahl wird er zwei, drei Wochen vorher die Chance über diese Zeit.
This is the video that brought down Mr. Kurz's last coalition with the far-right Freedom Party. It shows the Freedom Party's former leader at a villa in Ibiza, apparently offering state contracts to a woman who was posing as the niece of a Russian oligarch. Despite the scandal, many believe Mr. Kurz will once again try to form an alliance with the far-right. But the political analyst Thomas Hofer says that could be risky.
A nightmare for Sebastian Kurz would be the scenario where he's forming a new coalition with the Freedom Party, and then the whole thing falls apart again. And there is a pretty good chance that this might happen again. And this would mean for him that his image is also gone.
Other Austrians say they simply don't trust Sebastian Kurz. Clemens is from Vienna.
He is not interested in anything at all politically. I think he's a politician who is only working on creating surfaces. And he's very, very successful on that basis, and I don't really know why.
After the election at the end of September, it could take weeks to form a coalition. For now, politics is still in summer mode, but a busy autumn lies ahead.
Bethany Bell in Burgenland in eastern Austria. A 9-year-old girl has been told she can't join a prestigious all-boys choir in Germany after going to court claiming sex discrimination. The schoolgirl auditioned for the choir earlier this year but was rejected. Judges said the Berlin State and Cathedral Choir had an artistic right to reject the girl to preserve its distinctive sound. This report from our Europe regional editor, Mike Saunders.
Oh,
That's the quality the Berlin State and Cathedral Choir wants to maintain. It's been boys only since Frederick II, Elector of Brandenburg, founded the choir in 1465. The unnamed girl at the centre of the case wanted to change that. The choirmaster, Kai-Uwe Jirke, conceded that she has a good voice. She already sings with two high-level choirs that admit girls, but not quite the right timbre for an ensemble that performs with the likes of the Berlin Philharmonic. The girl's mother said the choir, which receives public funding, excluded her daughter because of her gender. The judges acknowledged a conflict between two constitutional rights, artistic freedom and freedom from discrimination. They've given the mother leave to appeal.
Our Europe regional editor, Mike Sanders. A council in South London has unveiled the city's first permanent rainbow street crossings in solidarity with the LGBT community. The pedestrian walkways, painted in the distinctive stripes of the pride colours, can be seen on four major roads in the borough. Stephanie Prentice has more.
The annual Pride Festival in London is one of the biggest in the world, with millions of people taking to the streets to celebrate LGBT communities. This year, pedestrian crossings all over the city were painted in bright rainbow colours, similar to flags and decorations used in the Pride celebrations. And they went down so well that now in one corner of the city, they're here to stay. Lambeth, a borough south of the River Thames, has proudly unveiled four permanent rainbow crossings. Sonia Winifred is the Cabinet Member for Equalities and Culture at Lambeth Council.
I think now more than ever, we need to come together in unity. So we thought this would be a great way of showing our support, and we've had no one against it.
The move comes as pride symbols in other parts of the UK have been rejected. During a recent event in the Midlands, flags were torn down and abuse hurled at some of those attending. And a bus driver in southeast England refused to drive his vehicle featuring pride colours because he said it promoted homosexuality. Sydney Bertrand Shelton is from the Stonewall LGBT rights charity and told me more about why symbols like this are so important.
A crossing like this sends such a powerful, visible signal to LGBT people that we are welcome, and also to the area more broadly that homophobic, biphobic and transphobic bullying and language won't be tolerated. The smallest thing can really make the biggest difference to any young person or any adult feeling like they can be welcome in a space. And it shouldn't be determined by who you love or who you are. You should be welcome.
Stephanie Prentice. And that's it from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this edition or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, goodbye.